Hello and welcome to Different Leaf, a show for new and experienced cannabis consumers. I'm Britt Smith. We made it through 2021, you guys, and oh, what a year it's been. From the huge increase in licensed cannabis businesses, including our first recreational delivery licenses, to the groundbreaking lawsuits that could shape the way the state's marijuana industry functions, Massachusetts has seen a lot of major changes happen this year when it comes to the developing world of weed. And today's guest has been following all of it incredibly closely, every single step. Joining us today to break down all the major Massachusetts pot stories of 2021 is Boston Globe cannabis reporter Dan Adams. Dan joined the Globe about a decade ago, reporting on politics, business, and alcohol, and he moved into covering the cannabis industry in 2017 when it officially kicked off. This year, Dan has continued to give the state detailed coverage of all the biggest moves in Massachusetts cannabis, including in his weekly newsletter, This Week in Weed. And his most recent report, which gave a thorough overview of what has happened since the state legalized 5 years ago. So let's see what's changed since the start of 2021 and what Dan thinks we might see in 2022. So, Dan Adams, thanks so much for joining us today. Pleasure to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I don't think we've seen each other in person in years, maybe since pre-pandemic.
Yeah, it's really been too long. And, you know, one of the things that stinks most about the pandemic is missing out on all those in-person events where you run into people. And I always say, you know, with those conferences and things, it's not so much the panels that are pre-arranged where you hear the interesting stuff. It's always in those conversations when you bump into people in between sessions or afterwards. Yeah. And I really miss getting that kind of intel.
But this year, even though a lot of it's been spent inside again, a lot has happened in the world of weed, especially in Massachusetts. So I want to do a little year in review with you and look back over some of the articles that you've done from this year. Especially the 5 year in review piece that you did, because that was a really big milestone for Massachusetts. So let's start first back in January 2021. Our new cannabis control commissioner came in to replace my beloved Shalene Teitel, who left at the end of last year. So what's the new lineup been like? What have we been seeing from this group of control commissioners that's been different from the original cast?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? Because it wasn't just one new commissioner that came in. We've actually had, you know, within the last year-ish or so, four turnover from the original lineup. And it has definitely changed things a bit at the commission. Although I will say that the commission's job at the same time is changing a bit right now, right? I think that the early iteration of the commission was largely concerned with writing those initial regulations. And they were, you know, really starting from scratch with a lot of things, deciding how to define things, deciding which types of licenses would be offered to folks. So I think that this new commission now is really looking more at implementation. And they're also looking at legislation. It's a big change there is that they are now going to lobby on Beacon Hill much more actively for the bills that they'd like to see. They're going to go to lawmakers at the state level and say, this is what we need to carry out our mission as a regulatory agency. In the past, the original lineup of the commission hadn't been able to come to a consensus about how to do that kind of lobbying, and they did not really act as a coordinated unit. And so you would see different commissioners going to speak with legislators, sometimes, you know, bearing different messages of what they were looking for and what they supported or didn't support. And I think lawmakers found that a bit confusing. And so now, like you said, it's been 5 years since legalization. And as some of the problems and shortcomings in the industry and obstacles to entrepreneurs of color, things like that, as all that has come into focus, I think the commission now is going to be looking to the legislature to give them some more tools to solve those problems.
And there's definitely been some movement, which we'll speak about as we go through the months. There's been some movement towards whether the Senate will vote to allow, you know, certain powers to go to the commission over things like the HCAs, the host community agreements, which are essential for any businesses to open in Massachusetts. So I'm really glad that we have reporters like you who go to every weekly meeting that the cannabis control commissioners have and wraps it all up for us in a nice little bow.
Unfortunately, like you said, because this can be a kind of a technical subject, sometimes when you read the more, you know, local reporting on it, you will see stories where they're sort of repeating what public officials said about something, but they don't really understand the significance of it. And it again, just sort of even further confuses it for folks.
There's no better example than the next big piece of news that happened in January, which was the Commonwealth Dispensary Association lawsuit against the state was dropped. This was another really big story that was really, really great to have you kind of pick apart for us as it was happening. Can you explain sort of what was going on with that lawsuit?
Sure. That was definitely one that needed a little bit of explanation, but also I think I agree with you, was hugely significant, kind of actually a watershed moment in the story of cannabis in Massachusetts. So essentially what happened is the Cannabis Control Commission created a new kind of delivery license, these so-called delivery operator licenses. And they would essentially allow companies that get this license to act like a marijuana store without a storefront, meaning they could order bulk, you know, wholesale quantities of product from suppliers, you know, so they could go to a grower and get like many, many pounds of it, you know, package that cannabis and sell it themselves. That's different from the other kind of delivery license that had previously been conceived, which was a marijuana courier. That's sort of more like an Uber Eats scenario. That's just a driver going to a store to pick up an order that's already been prepared for you, that's waiting on the shelf. This is more like you're running the store yourself. And the idea was, let's award these licenses for the next 3 years only to equity applicants. We haven't seen the kind of participation in the industry that we'd like to. It's still very much dominated by these larger interstate investor-backed, you know, white-owned companies. That's falling short of our mandate. Let's really do something aggressive here. Let's carve out a window where equity applicants will really have a chance to get a meaningful slice of the pie in this industry, which is what state law says they're supposed to get. And the existing retailers were very unhappy about this new license. They felt like this is a new kind of competition for us that has the unfair advantage of, you know, they're not operating a store where people are going to line up on the sidewalk. There's no consumer interactions there. So they get to set up, they're sort of thinking, hey, it's going to be way easier for them to get set up on the municipal level, less opposition. It's just a warehouse with some delivery vans coming and going. They're going to get in there and they're going to run circles around us. They're going to be able to bring products to people's doors. And we, meanwhile, have to work with these couriers to do delivery, which is not as profitable for us. And, you know, basically just saying it's unfair. So they filed this lawsuit against the state, kind of throwing a bunch of different claims at the wall about why this whole licensing scheme was illegal, and just sort of trying to, you know, protect their place in the market, I think. And also because they felt really strongly that the regulation as written was not legal. But ultimately, activists brought so much pressure around this in support of this kind of pro-equity licensing policy that most of the companies in the industry association that filed it got cold feet. I shouldn't say most, excuse me, but I should say a significant number of companies that had once been members of the Commonwealth Dispensary Association suddenly started dropping out because they were, I think, feeling really, you know, pressured. They were feeling really exposed. People were talking about, you know, organizing a boycott around this. So I think that spooked some of the companies, and they said, wait a minute, you know, are we on the right side of this thing? And they ultimately withdrew that lawsuit and left that association significantly diminished in terms of its size. And so that was a moment where I think, you know, the activist side of the cannabis community would tell you that they scored a major victory.
I think you're right. I think that they seem to work very hard for their platform, and it's one that you can see many of the same characters for years and years and years if you closely watch the way that the Massachusetts cannabis industry moves. After the CDA dropped that lawsuit, we saw another major win for activists, for folks who are trying to question the status quo of the laws and the rules as they are, when Northampton dropped their fees of impact for new cannabis businesses. These are major fees on top of the 3% fees that cannabis businesses are required to pay.
So at the state level, there's essentially a 17% tax on recreational marijuana sales. At the local level, there's usually a 3% further tax, local tax, on those retail marijuana sales at the register, you know, charged to the customer. But then in addition to that, there's a provision in state law that allows municipalities to charge the marijuana businesses so-called community impact fees. And the idea in the law, at least, was that these fees would go to offsetting any impacts that these businesses had. And they capped the value of those fees at 3% of a company's annual revenue. What has happened in reality is that almost every community, not all, but almost every community has basically just charged businesses that maximum 3%. And they haven't really taken it and, you know, delineated it, broken it out and said, these are the impacts you're having. And this is why we need this money to cover these impacts. You know, drug use is going up, whatever the problem is, you're causing it. We can show that. And, you know, here's some money to remediate it. And many, many communities, again, not all, but many communities will just take that money and more or less, you know, spend it on whatever, or you know, spend it on projects that you know, have only a very a spurious connection to the, and some businesses are now getting tired of this, but I don't want to skip ahead.
Sure. Yeah. We were getting to the good stuff, but Northampton dropping that impact fee joins one other town, I believe, Lee.
Yes.
The only other town.
Those are the two I've heard of. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So these two communities have basically now come forward and said, look, we can't really, you know, see any reason to keep charging this money. You're not really having any special impact on the community more so than any other business would. If we're not charging other businesses these kinds of fees, you're not really doing anything here negatively to the community. So they've now dropped that, and that's going to save those companies, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in fees. Yeah. It could also, you know, potentially cut some community organizations off from funding that they had enjoyed, although it was never going to be permanent.
It's been a very interesting one to follow as folks go back and forth on these different fees that cannabis companies should pay or should not pay. And as we see the law sort of get hashed out, it's interesting to me to see the kinds of towns that decide that they want to drop these fees in favor of allowing more companies to be able to thrive. And then what towns really seem to put up a very, very strong edge against that. In April, you published a very interesting story about the owner of STEM, Caroline Pignot, who is suing the city of Haverhill, which is her host city, for the impact fees. So again, we see a little bit more pushback. And this time it's actually a groundbreaking lawsuit because this is the first real company to push back against whether or not these impact fees are necessary.
Yeah, that's right. So she's the first person to sort of directly raise this issue in court of our municipalities within their rights to charge these kinds of fees in the very first place without a better basis for them, without being able to point to a specific impact and say, look, marijuana store, you had this impact on our community. You owe us X amount of dollars as a result of this specific thing. So she's really challenging the fundamental basis of this whole law, this whole fee system. And needless to say, the lawsuit is still sort of, you know, caught up in endless you know, appeals and rulings going back and forth. But from my read, you know, she's very much in the game here. The courts are taking this claim seriously. They're not being laughed out of court. And I think the courts are going to give a real close look at whether municipalities actually have this power.
We will have an episode with her coming up where she discusses her whole story and how she got into this. So this really interests me because what I think we're seeing when we take a bit of a step back and we look at Northampton dropping their impact fees, Caroline trying to sue over impact fees, what I'm really seeing is a pushback against the opportunity of corruption in the state. And this sort of harkens back to 2019 when the mayor of Fall River was found to be extorting cannabis companies essentially to get one of the coveted licenses in his city. I love to watch this movement of back and forth between business owners and lawmakers about what is a fair industry. Why do we have to pay you this? Why do you get to say that we should hand over this money? What is it for? You need to list this out for us.
Yeah, that has been one of the biggest plot lines in marijuana in Massachusetts over the last 5 years. This whole question of just how far local control goes. And I think on one hand, the Fall River case is an outlier. I don't think most municipal officials, or maybe even any other municipal officials, are corrupt on that level of, you know, sitting in the back of the car, where's my briefcase of money kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. But clearly, it's an example of the kind of leverage that elected officials like former Fall River Mayor Haziel Correa have over this process, right? He wouldn't have been able to demand those payments, allegedly, unless he had been the one who was able to make those decisions that had such a big impact that it was worth it to those businesses to potentially pay those bribes. So, right, it's indicative of a broken system. And I think that reality has been staring the legislature in the face for a number of years now. I think at the time of Correa's arrest, I mean, even had the U.S. attorney for Massachusetts at the time, Andrew Lelling, come out and say that the system was, you know, ripe for this type of corruption. And I think that since then, we've had ample documentation that this is not going well and not being carried out in a fair or logical way. I don't know what the solution to that is, but it does seem very obvious that there's an issue here. And I think there's growing impatience among people about the legislature's failure to so far to deal with it.
Of course, in April, we had 420. For the first time, we were not completely locked down. There was some events, sort of spaced out, masked events happening in Boston at the time. So, you know, it wasn't the best 420 in the world, but we did have record sales in Boston this year. And the state has actually topped $2 billion in revenue. So, you know, those are both signs from the 420 sales and from the yearly sales. They are signs that the growth of the market, it's moving in the right direction. We've seen a lot of companies open up over this year as well. So I think the sales record on 420, it's a good marker for how the industry is growing, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. The industry is getting a lot bigger. The Cannabis Control Commission has definitely picked up its pace of licensing over the past couple of years. So that pipeline just feels a little wider. It feels like, you know, almost every week, every other week, they're sending off a flurry of tweets telling us which companies are the latest to have been approved to actually open for business. And, you know, when we did that 5-year anniversary story a month or so ago that you mentioned, one of my colleagues made a little animated map. And you can watch all the different marijuana facilities sort of
pop up on
the map of Massachusetts. Oh my God, I stared at that thing for so long.
I hit a blunt and I stared at that and I was like, this is amazing.
I didn't say that just for the record, but I'm glad that you enjoyed it. That map, you can see it, right? You can see the acceleration in those dots, you know, exploding all over the map, right? At first it's a trickle, but now that pace has really picked up. Now that said, I don't think the industry has reached anywhere close to its full maturity. I think we're going to see, you know, a lot more retail still to come. And I think that there's going to need to be a rather large increase in supply to feed, so to speak, all those stores. I think one of the reasons that we're seeing the persistence of such high prices at dispensaries in Massachusetts is fundamentally just an issue of supply. There's a relatively small handful of mostly vertically integrated companies that are producing the bulk of the flower that's available at wholesale right now. And if you are the owner of an independent retail store that doesn't grow your own cannabis, your options for which brands you can carry on your shelves are really quite limited. And by the time you add a markup to that, that, you know, doesn't add up to a very impressive market for the consumer. So I just hear all the time from people about how frustrated they are with the poor selection at Massachusetts marijuana stores and also the high prices. And the market is growing, but, you know, not maybe as large as some consumers would like to see it grow.
Definitely. And those high prices, they still drive a lot of people to the underground market. One of your reports said 68% of sales are estimated to be still on the underground market. That's an incredibly high number. Do you put that down to the prices?
I think prices are a big factor in it. I also don't, I don't know that I have a ton of confidence in that being like the exact figure. I think it's probably about a year old too. So we've had a lot of stores open since then. And the prices have come down a little, not a lot, maybe 5 to 10% since the, dispensaries first opened. So I think that, you know, again, the increasing competition, the prices coming down, it will draw more people into the legal market. So I don't know, is it 68% today? It's probably not quite that bad. But yes, price is a huge factor in that. But I also think that there's consumers who are willing to pay for the reassurance that the product has been tested and produced by somebody licensed and reputable who, you know, didn't say, oh, crud, there's a bunch of bugs on my cannabis at the last second before harvest and just spray it down with whatever pesticide in their closet in Alston. I don't know.
Speaking from experience there, Dan.
I've seen some places in Austin that, you know, I've got some stories from my previous
life. We'll talk about that another time. So this year we have seen a huge uptick, as you were saying, in the licensing process. We have gone from, at the beginning of the year, we had 97 retailers, and now we've got 176. So, you know, that's almost 100% increase in the number of retailers that we have across Massachusetts. That's an up of 79. We've also seen a slight uptick in the number of product manufacturers. At the beginning of the year, that cool little map that your colleague did said that we had 38 product manufacturers. And at the end of the year, we have 53. So we've gone up by 15. It's a respectable number, I think, for manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And for cultivators, we've gone from 44 at the beginning of the year to 60 at the end of the year. So that's been an increase of 16 cultivators. And we've also had an addition of 4 independent testing labs. We initially, just at the beginning of the year, had 3 in the whole state, and now we have 7. It's been a pretty busy year in Massachusetts.
That's a surprisingly big deal about the labs, by the way, because that can become a real bottleneck on production, because all cannabis has to be tested, and doesn't matter how fast you can grow it and harvest it and do all that kind of stuff. But if it's just stuck there waiting for the lab to get around to testing it, and you're in line behind a bunch of other folks who sent their samples in first, you know, you're out of luck. And so I think that's something that the growers are definitely celebrating. But, you know, as you read those numbers, really, that increase in the number of cultivators is not going to cut it. That's not really such a huge increase. And also, I think it's important to continue asking, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but you know, who's getting these licenses, who's being able, you know, to open for business.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been 2 micro businesses open, which I am assuming are the delivery licenses that started this year. Is that right?
Some micro businesses are able to deliver. I think, though, that new micro businesses opening, those are usually either small growers or small processors. So that somebody who makes edibles or grows a very small canopy of marijuana.
Gotcha.
So that, and they have to be locally owned. That's the criteria. But right. Yeah, some of them can deliver too.
And in June, we did get our first recreational pot delivery, which was by Freshly Baked. And we have spoken to Philip Smith from Freshly Baked, so we've got an old episode with him. If you want to go check
that out. Have you done that? Have you used delivery yet? I haven't.
Not here. No, I've not tried it here. I tried it in California when I lived there all the time, but I actually like to go in and discuss my selection with somebody. So I don't just want to order it and have it delivered.
You like the personal interaction.
It's not really such a novelty to me to get it dropped off. Like, I live 5 minutes from a dispensary, but I do understand it if you don't live anywhere nearby.
Well, right. And not only if you don't live nearby, but unfortunately, you know, in municipalities in Massachusetts that have banned marijuana stores, brick and mortar stores, you are also not able to get recreational delivery in those towns. So you're sort of double dinged there.
Of course.
Yeah, I haven't tried the delivery myself either.
I did see some billboards.
We'll see it though. I was just gonna say, I mean, like you were saying, it's sort of ubiquitous in California these days, and I think that eventually we'll get there. I noticed just the other day I was pumping gas in Somerville, and one of the little ads came on next to the gas pump on the little screen, and it's for cannabis delivery platforms.
Oh wow!
It's coming.
Times are changing. Oh my gosh! Speaking of which, July was also a really big time for cannabis news in sports, because that was when runner Sha'Carri Richardson was banned from the Olympics. This story really made waves, even though she wasn't from Massachusetts. It made waves here with a lot of athletes, advocates, and we saw a lot of athletes come out not long afterwards saying, you know, cannabis and CBD has helped me through a lot of stuff. Notably here in Massachusetts was Paul Pierce, who was from the Celtics, who said that he has been using it for decades. That was a big piece that you wrote on the impact that Sha'Carri Richardson had here in Mass.
Yeah, that was such an interesting episode in the mix of this year's news, that like something I didn't really expect to to have to cover, and such an interesting kind of mixed reaction. I think some folks sort of saying, well, she deserved to get kicked out basically because, you know, she knew the rules, right or wrong. You know, sure. I got a lot of comments, a lot of emails from people sort of saying, you know, I don't have a problem with marijuana being illegal, but you know, she knew that she wasn't supposed to use it and she did, and so shame on her. I think that's a little simplistic in terms of how to view it. And I think it's especially simplistic in light of the fact that she, you know, I think had some really substantial family trauma, you know, just around that time. And it seemed like a very, to me, you know, the instinct to use a little cannabis in that situation was frankly relatable. And it seemed like a perfectly, you know, reasonable and rational thing to do that didn't, as far as I know, endanger anybody else or really endanger her health or anything like that. And so the sanction of, you know, having a lifelong dream, you know, that you work for every second of the day, you know, I mean, you don't get to the Olympics by being casual and how you eat, yeah, how you take care of your body, things like that, right?
So, and it comes around every 4 years.
I assume if Sha'Carri Richardson, you know, has incorporated cannabis into her routine, it's working with whatever, you know, she's doing athletically, yeah, because right, she's going to be in the Olympics, right? So that was the other half of the reaction, was folks sort of agreeing that, you know, the rest of us had no right to, you know, tell her what to ingest, mm-hmm, or you know, how to treat her pain. So definitely a complicated chapter there. But I think if anything good came out of it, I do think that now the sports authorities are going to take a closer look at those rules and whether they're really warranted, you know, serving any good. I think, mm-hmm, that the IOC and, you know, organizations like that are sort of saying, these weren't the headlines we were hoping to have. You know, let's take another look at these rules around cannabis. Maybe we can relax some of that a little bit, because it's, you know, it's not like steroids or something. So I'm curious to see where that conversation goes.
I am too. And just a few episodes ago, we had a really interesting conversation with Rachel Rapinoe, a former soccer athlete, and she is just a huge advocate of CBD. And we had an interesting conversation about how the different sports leagues treat cannabis, and that Major League Baseball doesn't care, and that NFL sort of has a small testing period, and how it's just differently treated by different sports bodies around the world, and how it really impacts athletes as humans, and that we often forget that that's what they are, and we use them a lot of the time as just entertainment, but that we have to, you know, also think of them and as fellow people in our society. Let them smoke weed, right?
Yeah, and again, I think the major sports leagues, like you said, they've really backed down from some of the more aggressive testing policies around cannabis. And I think that's essentially, that's not happening so much in response to changes in the law, in my opinion. That's happening in response to changes in public opinion,
yeah,
and how much of a quote-unquote scandal it would be if somebody, one of their teams, used cannabis. And I think their calculation is just that, yeah, no one really cares anymore. And it was really interesting to, you know, interview Paul Pierce earlier this year and to hear about how, you know, he had this really traumatizing experience where he was stabbed almost to death in a nightclub. And was really, really seriously wounded, and also was really seriously humiliated in the public, right? That the way that it was portrayed at the time was, you know, you're sort of this, like, you know, thuggy hood guy hanging around in nightclubs where you shouldn't be. Come on, like, focus on basketball. There was a lot of race, yeah, you know, racist thinking tied up, I think, in how that was presented at the time. And he was scared. He thought he was going to be attacked again.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to watch how these news stories really push the conversation forward in our culture and make certain things seem more acceptable and allow for conversations to happen in families and minds to change. All right. We are almost halfway through. Oh, no, we're more than halfway through the year. We're on to August. In August, the Boston City Council overhauled the licensing process. What changed exactly?
Right. So the system in Boston had, you know, already been pretty progressive. The system for awarding cannabis licenses in Boston, you know, basically gave half of them to equity applicants. And so what happened earlier this year was that Lydia Edwards, one of the city councilors, had proposed a series of sort of further revisions to this. Not all of them have gone through, though. So the one real key reform that she wants to make is she wants to take the ZBA, the Zoning Board of Appeal, out of the process. Mm-hmm. Right now, the way it's set up in Boston is that no one has the right, you know, as of right, they say in zoning, to build a marijuana store anywhere. You have to go get special permission from the ZBA every time. And so even though they have the Boston Cannabis Board, which sort of specializes in these types of businesses and licensing them and reviewing their applications, now you have this other development-oriented body also having to take a look at it. So Lydia Edwards was trying to get rid of that two-step process, get rid of the ZBA. Mm. She felt like they were making some arbitrary decisions.
Wow, we are seeing a lot of gatekeeping. I mean, really, that's if we're trying to take a wider view at what's happened this year, I think this is just another example of how folks who are trying to set up cannabis companies and those who are trying to live around cannabis companies are having this battle about who should be allowed and where. I wonder how much of the power will stay at the municipal level. I guess it's interesting to watch the shift.
And of course, one phenomenon with this is, right, is that the neighborhood group and the people who happen to participate in it are not always very representative of how that community feels on the whole.
Sure.
I've been to meetings in neighborhoods of Boston about proposed cannabis stores where I know from looking at the 2016 vote data that people in this neighborhood overwhelmingly backed legalization in 2016, like 70%, 80% more, you know, like overwhelmingly backed legalization. And yet neighbor after neighbor is like lining up at the microphone saying we can't have this in a, you know, in our neighborhood. So that, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with those people, and I'm not saying that their concerns are totally illegitimate. I'm just noting that sometimes those folks who line up to try to stop these projects don't always represent, I don't think, the overall opinion of the neighborhood.
Which is why people who do agree with something need to also go and voice their themselves so that it is equally represented what the opinion is. Finally, we close out the year with your five-year review, which was just an incredible wrap-up of what we have seen since legalization in Massachusetts in 2017, but really implementation in 2018. I moved here in the summer of 2017, so this is literally like I started here when cannabis got wreck, and I was like, all right, let's watch this baby bloom. So we've got 18,000 workers in the cannabis industry here in Massachusetts, $2.2 billion of revenue, 20% of which goes to municipalities. I don't know how that compares to other states, but it seems like just in the last year or so, that's really ramped up. Is that correct to assume?
Yeah, it's 20% tax overall. 3% of that goes to, you know, a 3% tax goes to the municipality. The other 17 goes to the state.
Okay.
But yeah, we've really just seen those numbers take off in a huge way this year. And those are as of early November, so it's even more now.
Yeah,
it's really become a major segment of the Massachusetts economy. Cannabis for cannabis to employ that many people, I don't think it's like we're bringing back manufacturing to all these mill towns, the way it used to be, not quite on that scale.
Yeah.
But I don't, headed in an upward direction, which is unusual, to see these days for that kind of job. So
Definitely. I'm excited to see how it grows. But as we were touching on the corruption and the impact fees a little bit, UMass Amherst did a study which found that there were nearly $2.5 million in excessive fees being charged in these host community agreements. So obviously still some major work to do. And hopefully we'll see in the new year whether the Senate takes over the host community agreements. Where do you think we're going to see with that?
Yeah, I think that this question of the host community agreement issue is probably first and foremost on the legislature's radar, if to the extent that cannabis is on its radar at all. The House, like you said, already passed a bill that would reform how these host community agreements are negotiated and putting in more oversight of them. However, that was last session, so the clock has now reset, and the House and the Senate are both going to have to, again, pass bills. The Senate never took it up last time. However, when I was reporting on the story, I was able to get the statement from the president of the Senate, State Senator Karen Spilka. And she said that host community agreements were one of her priorities around cannabis this session. So that should give people some hope. Mm-hmm. Another thing that she said was a priority that I thought was really interesting, which I also just wrote a story on recently, was expungements. So they can the process of wiping away old cannabis criminal records easier. So that was really interesting. She sort of brought that up unprompted.
That's good to know. The other thing that you'd noted in this five-year review was that there has not been what a lot of folks were afraid of, which was an uptick in stoned driving that can be pointed out, or an uptick in teen use of cannabis. Notable because these were things that were really expected and feared about the legalized cannabis industry, and they're just not really things that we've seen manifest.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say on an objective level that most of the sky is falling kind of predictions from opponents of legalization have not come to pass. But that is different from saying that cannabis doesn't carry any risks and that there aren't some things that are concerning that we need to keep an eye on. I think, you know, as youth perception of the danger of cannabis goes down, it is likely, you know, it makes sense to me that we see some more use. And, you know, the numbers that we have access to really lag behind quite a bit. So like the most recent numbers on youth data are from like the very, very start of recreational sales. So I don't think we really have seen yet whether that's reflected. I don't expect it to. I don't think legal marijuana stores are selling to minors. I don't think they would miss their license over that for the most part.
I don't think they could. Yeah.
But again, you know, to the extent that it's normalizing things more and that, you know, the surveys do show a decrease in the perception of risk around cannabis, which might be an accurate, you know, decrease in the sense that the risks of cannabis have long been, you know, exaggerated. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's complicated. I just don't want people to think that, who cares, you know, all that stuff was totally made up. I mean, I do agree that the folks fighting legalization in 2016 were clearly wrong to predict that there would be these sort of like imminent, very visible public health catastrophes that we could like look out our window and see that we would hear about. That really is definitely not, it happened, but I don't think that means that we don't need to continue to put a public health lens on cannabis policy and keep an eye on this kind of stuff, because, you know, even as we learn more through science about the fact that many of these things, you know, supposed dangers were actually exaggerations, we are also learning things about the real risks, right? Science is moving forward in that way too, and we're it's very clear, anyone who looks with an honest eye at the research has to agree that there is a real risk to, you know, youth cannabis use from like teens and even into early 20s, that when the brain's developing, you know, heavy chronic use really does have a measurable effect. Maybe not always determinatively on the individual level, but all the longitudinal studies pretty much agree on that. So I think that all of us, whether we're for or against, should, I don't think it's unreasonable to hold out as a goal that, you know, we don't want to see youth consuming cannabis if we can help it, unless there's a real overriding like medical reason to, like a seizure disorder or something like that. I think it's something we should discourage, and it's something we should keep an eye on. But did the sky fall? No. And, and did I think it was going to? Also, no. You know. but we still shouldn't take our eye off it. So I don't, you know. So I don't mean to be too much of a downer. I just think sometimes we're too quick to just sort of hand wave it away. Like cannabis is utterly harmless, and you never need to worry about these kinds of things. And that's
there's got to be some balance there for sure. I love to watch where the medical research goes, so I'm definitely keeping my finger on that pulse in the new year. I am also really interested in seeing where the social equity applicants get their foot in the door in the new year, because like you said, this year we didn't see as much as we thought we might based on what the law says. I am hoping also that we're moving a little bit closer to federal legalization. What do you see happening in 2022? What are your predictions for the new year?
That's a good question. Like you, I'm very interested in the federal legalization discussion. I think, you know, there's a divide among people on the left who, you know, between people who would rather see more incremental reforms, like let's just fix banking so that marijuana stores don't have to sort of metaphorically hide their cash under the mattress, or, you know, use these sort of different financial workarounds because of the federal illegality of cannabis. So between people who would like to see, you know, just those reforms made in a vacuum tacked on to some other bill, and people who would like to see more comprehensive reforms that deal with the question of equity, that would really federally legalize the drug, reschedule it, or make some more sweeping change. I think that even though the polls are very clear that public opinion about legalization is very favorable, even across party lines, for whatever reason, that message has just had such a hard time trickling through to the heads of politicians on both sides of the aisle that it really is a popular stance to take. And I feel like some people are still just squeamish about it. Mm-hmm. And they don't see it necessarily as a priority with the pandemic still going on, which, you know, fair enough. And another really interesting dynamic there, right, is Biden. Biden did not campaign on legalization like pretty much everybody else in that race on the Democratic side did. He campaigned for just decriminalizing. And also talked about letting some nonviolent cannabis offenders out of prison, which is yet to happen. But you know, even if Congress passed comprehensive reform, would Biden sign it? I think that's a totally open question. He might not, even if the Democrats came to him and said, we delivered this to you. He might send it back and say, I don't want to legalize it like that. I still want states to be, you know, so I think I don't actually have a ton of hope necessarily that this issue is
going to get over
the finish line in the next year. So that's one prediction I'll make. I think that the federal thing is going to keep inching forward. We're going to have some votes. There's going to be some historic firsts, you know, some key committee is going to do something it's never done before. But I think at the end of the year, we'll still be sitting here kind of having the same tug of war over what the bill looks like. But I do think it's really important that, like, there are actors in Washington, D.C. There are people like Philip Morris, big cigarette companies, other, you know, big alcohol companies, you know, alliances of convenience stores that sell lots of tobacco products. They're angling for one kind of federal legalization. And it's not the same kind as people who are advocating for something that looks like racial justice after all these years of highly racially disproportionate arrests for cannabis. And so I think we can't let people reduce this to a yes or no conversation. We need to remember that on the yes side, there are people who are purely in it for the buck and are not maybe people that we would be happy about writing our laws for us. And these cigarette companies, some of them really have a long, well-documented history of abusing the public trust, right? And so do we want those same corporations to be driving the bus of cannabis policy on the federal level? That kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. So I think what I hope is that the conversation next year gets a little more in depth and pulls apart those sort of different camps and thinks about what we really want.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't be so hasty. Maybe we should take it slowly, as you're saying, and make sure that we're covering all the tracks, because as you said, Massachusetts is more of a cautionary tale than it is a model. So very interesting to keep up with how it develops. And Dan, for most of us in Massachusetts, you're the person that we rely on to explain exactly what we're interested in. So thank you for your reporting in general. And thank you for joining us today to have a look back over 2021. I've really enjoyed catching up with you. Thank you so much for being here.
I've really enjoyed it too, Brett. Thank you. And thanks for those kind words. Much appreciated. It's a pleasure.
A major thanks to today's guest, Dan Adams of the Boston Globe. Be sure to sign up for his weekly newsletter, This Week in Weed. And thanks again to all of our guests this year. We hope that you've enjoyed learning from each and every one of them as much as we have. Different Leaf will be back in the new year with more great podcast episodes and some brand new issues of Different Leaf the magazine, which you can buy at differentleaf.com or at your local Barnes & Noble bookstore. Make sure you're following us on social media at Different Leaf and at @different_leaf. And I'm on social media at Brit the British. Thanks as always to our producer, Andrea Maraskin, and thanks to Homebody for the music. Happy New Year, everybody.